John Rourke was halfway along the corridor's length when he felt a cold draft of wind. A fireball filled the hospital corridor and blew along its length, rolling toward him on the air current from the shattered window. Rourke threw his body against a patient door. He hit the floor in a roll and came down hard on his left shoulder as the flames gushed past him. He was up, framing himself just inside the doorway. The Smith & Wesson revolver in his right hand, he pulled the AG Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome free of its sheath with his left. The sprinkler system switched on, instantly soaking the facility in icy cold water. The fireball was gone, but flames licked everywhere along the corridor and continued to spread. Rourke tentatively stepped into the corridor, a little .38 special revolver tight at his right hip, the knife in a rapier hold along the outside of his left thigh. Rourke ducked back from the hail of submachine gun fire. Who fired that first shot?
Gotta find Sarah and Natalia and make sure the patients are safe. So, John, get out of here, get some weapons, and stop whoever's attacking this place.
John spotted an empty stainless steel bedpan near the foot of the hospital bed. He put two pistol shots through the room window, enough to spiderweb the safety glass. Then he grabbed the bedpan and smashed it through the glass repeatedly until he had a space big enough to crawl through. Icy wind licked through the opening. John grabbed the visitor chair from the foot of the bed, put it beside the window, stepped up and clambered through the opening, jumping down into the drifted snow beside the wall. The cold thoroughly numbed him now, but Rourke moved through the snow nonetheless. He swapped the two spent rounds and the three remaining rounds for another Safariland speed loader. John moved along the side of the building wall, the fully loaded revolver tight in his right fist. Though gunfire continued, John heard no sounds of the German-built fire or emergency equipment from Eden Base.
God.
The knife, clamped in Rourke's teeth, kept them from chattering as he moved through the cold. Beside the corner where the outer walls met, Rourke stopped. He parked the gun in his belt and put his remaining rounds into the speed loader. At least now he could reload quickly, but with only three rounds. The revolver still in his belt, the knife back in his left hand, Rourke peered around the corner. He saw four men standing at the doorway with submachine guns, German issue, all four covered in Arctic gear. The men stood near the flames licking from the doorway. They were taking grenades from their web gear. A fifth man apparently stood watch some distance back toward Eden's single street. Rourke dropped to his knees and elbows. Taking advantage of the high drifts of snow as concealment, he crawled away from the corner and along the driveway toward the fifth man. This was his logical target, the fifth man carrying an M16.
How about that gun serial number? Matches up with the list of the M16s missing from the Eden Project stores. God.
Rourke moved as quickly as he could, fingers stiffening, ears numbing. He quickened his pace beyond what he thought possible. He was at the end of the driveway now, roughly parallel to the man with the M16, still about 10 yards from him. It would have been an easy shot, even with his hands trembling slightly from the cold, but the shot would draw attention despite the crackle of the orange flames licking across the hospital roofline. Instead, Rourke raised up from his knees into a crouch, rolled over and moved partially through the snowdrift, coming up to his full height. Rourke rammed the knife into the man's carotid artery as they fell to the frozen driveway and smashed the attacker's face into the ground. He raked his knife across the M16 sling, tore the Colt assault rifle free of the body, wheeled the muzzle around, and moved the selector to full auto. Rourke cut down the first of the four men near the hospital's main entrance just as the man lobbed a grenade through the flames in sync with two of the others. He fired as the three men started to turn, too late to return fire. Explosions rocked the hospital. A portion of the north wing's roof collapsed. The rifle was empty. Rourke threw it down.
No!
He was on his feet and running for the flaming entrance to the hospital.
Oh! Oh!
Annie fell to her knees.
Annie, what is it?
It's Mama. Oh, she's having the baby. I can feel it. Oh, and she's in pain. Hurry to her. I'll be there in a minute.
But Annie!
Hurry, Paul!
All right, but don't be long.
Paul ran on.
Oh!
Annie knelt in the snow, her hands clasped to her abdomen and her groin. The empathic pain she experienced felt as real and devastating as if it were her own. From where she knelt, she could see flames leaping from the hospital roof, licking voraciously skyward. Sarah Rourke, her pistol clutched in her right hand, fought against the cramping that seized her, consumed her, and dragged herself along the floor into the corridor. She dragged herself because she could not walk. The first of the explosions knocked her to the floor. On her knees beside the corridor wall, she sagged, felt the movement of the baby. It had to be a boy, racing to the sound of battle just like his father, but not now. She tried to get to her feet, but could not rise. Acrid smoke filled the corridor, filling her lungs and the baby's bloodstream, too.
Oh, please. The baby. Please, not that.
The emergency entrance to the hospital was only a few yards away.
The back door, it's close. I can get there. I can get there. Oh, where is John? And Natalia? Where's Natalia?
Sarah shivered. If neither John nor Natalia had come for her, that meant they were perhaps in greater danger than she. Michael slowed as he neared his sister.
Annie!
I'm all right! Ooh. Mom's having the baby! Help, Paul! Go on!
Michael, his pistols in his fists, ran full out toward the flames. But it was too late. John Rourke ran into the flames, into the burning hospital. Paul Rubenstein, his eyes flooding with tears, knew why and kept running toward the building to do the same. Dietrich Zimmer went from right to left through the doorway, his two lieutenants already through ahead of him. The fire was spreading faster than he planned, but his mission was clear and could not be sacrificed for concerns of personal safety. 17 patients escaped through the emergency entrance, but escaped only to death. They were all followers of Dieter Bern, as such, unworthy of life. The woman, Sarah Rourke, was not among them. It was for her now that he searched. Through smoke so thick he could barely breathe or see, Rourke stumbled over a body in the corridor just inside the doorway, a woman's body. He felt for a pulse. There was none, not even a weak one he could detect. As his hand drifted along the wrist, he felt the face of a watch, the shape of which was quite familiar.
Natalia!
She was dead.
Natalia! Oh.
He swept her up into his arms. Tears streamed over his face. He freed the gun in her hand and pulled her coat up over her as much as possible to protect her exposed skin. John swept her up in his arms and started back through the fiery doorway. He could see Paul nearing the building.
Stay back!
John ran clear of the building and dropped to his knees with Natalia. Paul knelt beside him.
I think she's dead, but don't give up on her. Try CPR. Don't give up.
Rourke started to his feet and doubled over. Paul grabbed John.
You can't go in there, John. You can't.
John shoved Paul's hands away. Paul grabbed at him again, trying to turn him around. John straight-armed Paul in the chest, sending him sprawling, then ran to the doorway again, into the inferno.
Help us! Please, help us!
Where's the screams coming from?
Dietrich Zimmer followed the sounds of the screams. For a moment, as he stepped through the doorway, he thought he had found Sarah Rourke. A woman in a hospital gown huddled in the far corner, clutching an infant to her breast. But the woman was not Sarah Rourke. Something moved Dietrich Zimmer. Not compassion, but inspiration. Rourke was nearer to the room occupied by Lieutenant Larimore and her infant son than his office, and Sarah was mobile, had probably escaped already. He made for Lieutenant Larimore's room.
Bastards!
As John neared Lieutenant Larimore's doorway, three men wearing gas masks and oxygen breathing apparatus emerged. The third stepped back inside quickly as the other two turned toward Rourke. Rourke put down one of the men. As Rourke wheeled on the second man and fired, the second man lobbed something toward him. Rourke threw himself forward to escape the grenade. The walls around Rourke, already smoldering, crashed down around him in flames as he fell into darkness. Something exploded, and the forward central section of the hospital caved in on itself.
No, God, no!
Michael stripped away his parka, threw it into the snow, and shrugged out of his shoulder holster as Paul packed snow over his own parka. Annie knelt beside Natalia's body.
We're going in! Keep up the CPR until help comes. Maybe we can save her.
Paul and Michael threw their coats over their heads, necks, and shoulders and dashed through the scant break in the wall of flames. Wolfgang Mann stomped the accelerator of his staff car as he swung through the apex of the curve.
Look at the flames, Wolf!
The night sky was orange. Where the hospital walls once stood, only sheets of flames rose into the air. Mann's hands clenched the wheel. The only emergency sirens to be heard over the crackling of the flames were those of the vehicles following him. Nothing was coming from Eden Base. Sarah squatted with her back against the wall.
Come on, Sarah! We've been delivering their own children since we dropped out of the trees!
The smoke made her cough and gag, but the baby's head crowned. Blood oozed along her thighs, her flesh ripping.
John!
Something enormous was pushing through her, tearing her, sending waves of pain through her body no matter how she tried to control her breathing. More pain swelled through her, and then it was gone. Blood and fluid dripped from her, but her baby's head was out. She bore down with her shoulders, her ribcage, her pelvis, pushing as hard as she could, unable to move her hands to help herself lest she fall. The child slid the rest of the way from her body.
Oh my God! Oh my God, you're alive! Little one, where's your father?
Sarah raised the new life to her chest, a boy.
Very impressive, Frau Rock.
Tears filled Sarah's eyes. She looked up toward the mechanical-sounding voice. It came to her through some sort of mask. Her baby's body was slick and at the same time sticky. The umbilical cord was still attached, blue and pulsing. The man speaking to her held a gun in his hand.
This is for your crimes against National Socialism, Frau Rock.
She saw a flash from the muzzle of the gun. Michael and Paul fell back from the flames, collapsing in the snow.
We have to get in there!
Around to the back!
Annie, her face buried in her hands, body doubled over, head nearly in her lap, rocked in the snow next to Natalia's body. Paul Rubinstein wanted to take his wife into his arms. Instead, he pushed himself to his feet and ran along what remained of the burning north wall of the building to reach the rear entrance. Zimmer ran through the snow, carrying the Rourke child wrapped in its dead mother's coat, its umbilical cord still attached. A helicopter would be waiting over the rise. Inspiration separates a few men from their inferiors. And this child, taking this child of fate, was inspiration on the grandest scale. The rear entrance was clear. Guns in hand, Michael and Paul ran toward it. They ran through the doorway, entering a bank of smoke and flame. The smoke swirled in a vagrant current of fresh air from the open doorway, and Michael saw her. His mother lay in a pool of blood, blood between her legs, blood covering her face. A bullet wound by her left temple.
Mom!
Michael fell to his knees beside her. She had had the baby, but the baby was gone.
God damn them! I'll look for your father! Mom! Oh, God, Mom!
Michael thrust his pistols into his waistband, then lifted his mother into his arms and carried her from the burning building. Paul stumbled through the inferno, his eyes streaming tears.
Sarah's dead. It can't be. Oh, God, it can't be. After all of this, Sarah and Natalia in one night. Ah!
Paul's hands shook with rage and fear. If John didn't stop this, it meant John was...
Ah!
Paul kicked his way through a burning sheet of plasterboard and ran on, holding the coat over him. The corridor took a bend, and he was at John's office. The door was open. There was no one inside.
The woman in it.
Paul leaned against the office wall, trying to get a breath.
John would have gone to find Lieutenant Larimore. He must have thought that Sarah could make it out herself.
Paul moved along the corridor. Trying to orient himself, he turned to his left. The corridor walls and ceiling lay in ruins. A wall of flame stood between him and the debris.
John! John! Where are you, John?
The walls and ceiling creaked. In seconds, Paul knew the building would collapse, and with it, all hope. But if he could find John, find anyone alive, the Germans and the Americans at Midwake did wonders with skin grafts. Inhaling as deep as he could, Paul pulled the coat tight around his head, ran toward the flames, and jumped. He was through. He threw himself against the wall, rolling against it to extinguish the fire, beating at his legs with his coat, his left arm cold with pain. He could hardly see, but there was a pile of rubble just ahead of him. He staggered toward it.
John!
It was John, beneath flaming pieces of the walls and ceiling.
John!
Paul dropped to his knees beside his friend, threw his weight against the rubble, sending chunks of it skidding away. He grabbed still-hot pieces of steel, blistering his hands as he touched them.
John!
John's upper body was free, a huge fragment of steel protruding from his back. Paul leaned over his friend, protecting John's body with his own, kicking at the rubble pinning John's legs, kicking at it, pulling at John's upper body, praying he was doing the right thing, not killing his friend by moving him.
Oh, please, God, don't let me kill him.
Paul fell back. John pressed against him.
God, save him!
Paul dragged himself to his knees, pulling at John, pulling him up. Paul bent forward as low as he could, getting his right shoulder beneath John. Then, trying to kneel, Paul reached out his burned and blistered hands, grasping at the wall, at anything, for support. Paul lay sedated. His hands so badly burned that, in conjunction with the burns on his legs and left arm, he needed surgery, and the only relief from his pain would be in sleep. Annie, arms hugged close against her, sat on the edge of a straight-back chair, her smoke-smudged nightgown all but in tatters, a blanket wrapped around her. With shoulders hunched forward, she sat, a blank look in her eyes, her mouth downturned. Hair pulled straight back. Face as pale as death, eyes filled with hate, Natalia entered the room. She wore German fatigue pants, surgical scuffs, and a khaki t-shirt.
You shouldn't be up.
Don't tell me what to do. You're not your father.
Sit down before you fall down.
Natalia glared at him, but sat on the remaining vacant chair. Michael Rourke watched her.
How are you all?
My lungs were flushed, my stomach was pumped, and they stimulated my heartbeat with high voltage. I have bruises all over my chest and my left breast. And I want to throw up, but there isn't anything in my stomach. I am just fine.
She looked away, started to light a cigarette, broke it in half, and threw it into the ashtray on the desk near her.
How are you?
I wish I smoked.
Michael didn't want to answer her. He learned that when the medical team accompanying Colonel Mann arrived, Dr. Munchen injected Natalia with drugs designed to regulate her heartbeat. Her heartbeat had been so low, so erratic, that they initially mistook her for dead.
Thank God they saved Natalia. But was she the only one they could save? Did they do anything else right? Damn it, Michael, of course they did. They did everything possible to save Mom and Dad. Face facts. Natalia was by the front entrance, what had been the front entrance. She was the first person they got to.
Michael closed his eyes, sat on the edge of Dr. Munchen's desk, and waited. But his mind could not rest.
What happened to Dad just happened. But those sons of bitches went after Mom. They assassinated Mom. And where is the baby?
Dr. Munchen entered the office and stood in the doorway. Michael stared at him. Annie did not move.
Well?
The child was a boy. We were able to tell from amniotic fluid residue taken from Sarah's thighs. There is no reason to suppose that anything was wrong with the child. That is the good news.
Annie didn't look up.
Tell them.
Michael stared at her, wondering if she already knew.
The bullet that penetrated Sarah's skull essentially killed her.
Michael stood up, his hands trembling.
What the fuck does essentially mean?
Munchen's eyes were very tired.
There is nothing in our power now that can alter the state of your mother's condition for any positive result. but she is still perfectly alive in the physical sense.
Jesus.
Michael made the sign of the cross. The bullet entered the brain in such a manner that its path evidently did little damage. And there is a remarkable tendency for the brain to heal itself, for one portion of the brain to take over the function of a portion that has been damaged. But the bullet is buried in an area of the brain that is inaccessible in a living patient by any means at our disposal. To remove the bullet, without going into medical explanations, none of you, and I mean no offense by this, of course, but that none of you would understand, would kill her instantly. Researchers in both New Germany and Midwake have been studying the brain in great detail for the past 5 centuries, as, of course, have Soviet researchers. This is nothing new, certainly. The brain, as the seat of personality, of being who we are, is the ultimate quest in medicine. We have known for centuries that the brain feels no pain, yet makes its own painkillers to assist those portions of the body which do feel pain. Endorphins and other natural drugs are just a part of the chemical defenses the brain can muster to support the host body during times of stress. Because Sarah had just given birth, her body was pumped with natural chemicals, things to give her greater endurance, things to give her greater strength, things to help her control the pain and discomfort of her sudden childbirth. Add to this that she was already in another crisis situation, namely the burning hospital, the fact that she had to be uncertain about John and Natalia as well. Then, as all these chemicals are beginning to rebalance in her body and her brain, along comes whoever the assassin was, and there is an instantaneous surge of various of these chemicals as the brain and the body try to prepare for an anticipated known trauma.
But Mama isn't dead.
No, she is not. But she is comatose, and in light of current technology, there is no way to remove the bullet that caused the condition. Dead and alive cease to have meaning in such a situation as this. With X-ray tomography, we have located the bullet, but seeing it and getting at it are two different things. The bullet is lodged near the postnodular fissure on the undersurface of the cerebellum. No tool can reach it, let alone extract it, without killing Sarah. No technique of microsurgery currently known, no laser surgery, nor any method currently under development can effectively assist Sarah Rock.
What about Dad?
Michael watched Munchin's face. Your father suffered burns, none of them serious. He suffered various traumatic bruises, which will heal. Unlike your mother, he suffered no penetration of the brain or the body. Yet, very like your mother, he is comatose. Evidently, the roof materials that crashed down on him caused several incidents of trauma to the brain, concussion. But all of these will eventually heal. Dr. Rourke's problem is more complex. To have a chance of saving Sarah, we need the right tools and procedures. These do not exist. But for John, I do not know. He could awaken in 10 seconds, or he might never awaken. I am not a specialist in these matters, but I know the literature. Like your mother, he may have assumed at the instant that the explosion or structural collapse caught him that this was in fact the end, that he was dead. Add to that the peculiar nature of John Rourke's personality, and the problem we may face begins to take shape. John, like any man, would reject death. But unlike most men, he has an almost pathological sense of duty. It is likely he suspected that Sarah might still be in the building. From where he was found, he was evidently en route to locate Lieutenant Larimore and her baby in order to rescue them. Death meant no more to him than the loss of his life, something he had risked on occasions too numerous to count. It meant the inability to do what he must do. It meant failure. I may be very wrong, and I certainly hope that I am. Yet I suspect that what makes John Rourke comatose is his inability to accept the fact that just this once he did not succeed. In effect, his brain is rejecting contact with reality, almost angry with his body for failing to shrug off the building materials that collapsed on him and drove him into unconsciousness. So angry with the body that it may well have disassociated itself from the body.
What are you talking about?
Natalia stared down at her hands. They were shaking. For a human being to function, brain and body must work together. The brain controls the body, but the body affects the brain because the brain is physical. It is an organ, like any other in that respect. The brain has defenses for the body and for itself. One ultimate defense is the total rejection of what surrounds it. This only occurs in cases of severe trauma coupled with great stress. John Rourke had a mission. He was unable to fulfill this mission. Somewhere deep inside his psyche, his brain is rejecting awakening because of this perceived failure. His brain is giving all the appearances of shutting down the biological system that supports it. John's blood pressure, heart rate, everything is declining, as if death were imminent. Brain activity, measured electrically, is subsiding rapidly to death. We can keep him alive on machines, as we do now, but that is not the answer, nor is it even an effective temporary solution. He can only decline so far before this lack of cooperation between his inner self and his physical being will begin to take its toll on the brain as an organ, in a way that is very physical. He would still be alive, but he would be nothing more than a shell, never to awaken again, merely living on solely because of the machines that support him, even as we speak.
I'm getting nothing from Mom. It's like she's dead, but Daddy, there's something there, but I keep losing him, and then he comes back, and each time it's worse. What I feel is weaker, harder to reach.
What about what John did when I was ill?
Natalia looked at Munchin. That was most ingenious and daring and inventive, and thankfully quite effective. However, Fräulein Major, the situations are totally dissimilar.
He's right. I couldn't reach into Daddy's mind, and neither could you.
The concept of mind is the key to understanding here. There is a tendency to look at the brain as some mystical thing. It is a physical organ, and what occurs, occurs because of physical processes. Some from within the brain itself, and some from without. Internal and external stimuli, if you will.
So, what are we supposed to do? Let Mom be brain dead and Dad just die?
Before Dr. Munchin could answer, Wolfgang Mann and Commander Dodd, an odd pairing to be sure, appeared in the outer office. Munchin turned toward them.
Colonel?
Commander Dodd wishes to speak with all of you. I thought it best to accompany him under the circumstances.
Dodd entered the inner office and stood just inside the doorway. Colonel Mann, worn-looking, sad-eyed, stood in the doorway just behind him. Dodd put his hands on his hips.
What is it that you want?
I came to express my condolences on your bereavement. What a fine and brave family to endure such terrible emotional hardships. Dr. Rourke and his wife will be sorely missed. I have a responsibility to the citizens of Eden, which, however onerous, must be carried out.
What?
There has been a crime. The person or persons responsible must be apprehended if society is to continue, if there is to be civilization here rather than chaos.
I agree. We need to take the killer and kill him, hard.
Michael stood, looking at Dodd, and took a step toward him. Dodd stood his ground.
I'd never thought a Rourke would feel differently. That's why I must do what I must do.
And what the hell is that?
To thoroughly investigate this crime, we need evidence. And as far as I am able to ascertain, Dr. and Mrs. Rourke died intestate.
They are not dead.
Natalia stood, throwing her shoulders back.
Their deaths are a matter of time, if I properly understand their conditions. Therefore, I am officially requesting, Colonel Mann, that their bodies be released to me, so that at the instant of death, Eden's resident physician can conduct a proper autopsy on each of them, to assist in accumulating evidence.
Against whom?
That is another reason I have come.
He has six armed men of Eden with him. He intends to arrest the Fraulein Major on suspicion of murder.
You pompous fucking asshole!
Michael jumped at Dodd, hands going for Dodd's throat. Michael's right knee smashing upward into Dodd's groin, hammering the man to the floor. Michael was atop him now, fingers closing tight around Dodd's neck.
Michael! Michael, stop! He's crazy! Dodd!
Michael, stop! This won't help!
Michael felt hands on his arms and shoulders, but he was so tightly focused on Dodd, willing the man to die, that he saw no one else.
Mike!
He looked up, into Natalia's eyes. She knelt beside him, her hands on his arm.
Not now.
The only person who ever called him Mike was his father, and only a few times in their two short lives together. Michael looked to his left. Annie and Dr. Munchin held his other arm. Michael looked back at Natalia. In that instant, he knew. Whether his parents lived or died, he had the mantle of his father's responsibility now. Lieutenant Larimore and her baby were burned to ashes. A few of Lieutenant Martha Larimore's bones, likely all that would be found. The other patients, all of them German, were dead. But the child to whom his mother gave birth only seconds before she was shot in the head might still live. Michael had to find that child and find the killers who destroyed the hospital. If he murdered Dodd now, the one who certainly planned the attack, he might sever the last possible link to the actual culprits, the last link to his newborn brother. He released Dodd's throat and stood up from the floor. Dodd lay there as Munchin briefly examined him. He checked his throat and took Dodd's pulse.
You appear well, Herr Commander.
Dodd looked up from the floor into Michael's eyes, but never quite held Michael's gaze.
I wasn't going to bring this up now, but I will. With your father and mother near death, and no clear will.
A will?
It is my duty as leader of Eden to impound the retreat and its contents until such time as proper legal proceedings can be established to dispose of the estate.
You can fuck off and die before you get my father and mother into your hands to kill them! And the retreat doesn't belong to you! And you don't know the way inside, you prick!
Commander, you may or may not have the right to seize the possessions and property of Herr Doctor and Frau Rourke, but this space constitutes the embassy of the Republic of New Germany in Eden, and as such cannot be subject to your civil authority. You cannot remove the Rourkes, nor can you arrest Fraulein Major Temerovna. John and Sarah Rourke will be flown away from here as soon as Dr. Munchin considers it medically advisable, then to New Germany or Midwake, where they will be given the finest care to be had in the hopes of their full and complete recoveries. And, although it is not my place to comment, once Akira Kurenami bests you in a free election, where are you? I might think of where on this small earth of ours to hide from the wrath of God and man. It is you, Herr Commander, and Nazi conspirators whom I think must be responsible for what has happened here this night. Once that is proven, you will be the sworn enemy of every free man, woman, and child. Enjoy your moment, for it will be your last.
Dodd got to his feet and made for the door. Wolfgang Mann interposed himself in the doorway between Dodd and the outer office.
I personally, Commander, count Frau Rourke as one of the finest persons I have ever known. That you authorized, or ordered, or even condoned what was done to her is beyond despicable. Were I a private citizen, I would kill you now. You disgust me so.
Where's our brother, Dodd?
I am not responsible to you.
Once you leave this facility, Herr Commander, I would walk quickly. And I would never keep myself alone, nor be without a weapon in instant reach. And Commander Dodd, avoid dark places.
Dodd looked at Natalia.
Will you surrender yourself to me for trial?
Natalia lit a cigarette.
I am not religious, but I am struck by the biblical story of Eden, Commander Dodd. There was a tempter, there were the tempted, but you have simultaneously offered the apple and eaten it yourself. Perhaps if I were to cut off your arms and legs, you could then crawl on your belly as you should.
Wolfgang Mann stepped aside. Dodd walked out. Michael Rourke looked out the office window. Perhaps there was symbolic meaning behind it, although he doubted that. But the morning sun crested the eastern horizon.
Paul should be well enough to travel in a few days.
Dr. Munchin, what is their fate?
Michael closed his eyes, no longer wishing to see the sunrise.
To prevent John's condition from further deteriorating, and to keep Sarah alive until someday there may be a procedure by which she can be saved, there is only one choice. A gamble at best. But they are man and wife, and at least they will sleep together.
The sleep.
Wind swept over the field. Light snow fell, driving hard against Jason Darkwood and Margaret Barrow. The J-7V that would transport them was waiting at the center of the field. Three more of the craft circled overhead, waiting as escort for the flight and now as sentries against the unexpected. Jason and Maggie would accompany John and Sarah Rourke to Midwake, where German doctors were already waiting to consult with their American colleagues. A Russian specialist from the underground city volunteered his services as well. Paul and Annie, Paul with his hands swathed in bandages and a large patch bandage on his left cheek, stood at the edge of the pad, Annie's long skirts blowing in the wind. Natalia looked at Michael standing beside her when he reached out and took her hand. She let him hold her hand, not knowing why she let him do so, or why he wanted to. Medical staff brought John and Sarah onto the field in hermetically sealed half-cylinders. Dr. Munchen walked beside them. Natalia could see their faces clearly, despite the fact that the left side of Sarah's face was heavily bandaged. She looked asleep, and so did John. Tears flooded Natalia's eyes.
No, now is not the time for tears. I must be hard now, harder than ever. I must avenge this act. I must find the child.
But her heart wavered. She could barely stand. Michael's arm went around her, and she leaned her face against his chest and wept.
Let it go. Let it go.
Natalia felt more alone than she had ever felt in her life. But Michael held her. A 21-member honor guard, men and women of Midwake and of New Germany, stood beside the flags of the United States, Midwake, and New Germany.
Fire!
Natalia raised her head.
I swear to your God, John and Sarah, I will never rest until we find the child and kill the men who did this.
Amen.
The election would be in a matter of days, the election for leadership of Eden, a mere handful of people deciding the future of what was once the United States. Would they choose to follow Akira Kuranami, who stood for honor and courage? Or Christopher Dodd, who was vile and despicable. Annie, her eyes burning from exhaustion and tears, dressed herself for the ordeal now facing them, where climate, as much as anything else, would be the adversary. She pulled on Chinese silk tights, heavy and black like her spirit, along with a cream-colored silk teddy of the kind Natalia always wore, also Chinese. Then over the tights, she stretched on heavy stockings of coarse black wool, elasticized at the thighs to stay up. Next, she stepped into a heavy silk slip, elasticized at the waist. The garment fell to mid-thigh level. When they found these creatures. Annie couldn't exactly say these people were killers. Certainly they were killers, but not killers of her parents, not yet, because her parents both lived in a strange, horrible way. Was life like that better than death? It would be a matter of a few days only before the decision would have to be made to put her mother and father into cryogenic sleep, the same procedure that saved all their lives, allowing them to sleep for 5 centuries, awaiting the return of the Eden Project.
What irony. The people Michael and I watched for in the night sky each and every night returned to bring this horror.
She finished dressing in her skirt and sweater. The logical starting place was Dodd, of course. It had to be Dodd. Akira and Elaine volunteered to return, but Michael and Paul insisted they should not until the eve of the election, and only then if he kept as close as possible under German security. Annie stepped into her boots and laced them up. The first step would be Commander Dodd, learning from him who had her unnamed brother and where they hid him. Paul, Michael, Annie, and Natalia had not decided what to do about Dodd. Kill him? Or let the election throw him out, ruin him, reveal him? Let new laws bring him to ground. Her boots tied, she donned her weapons. The little cold steel Mini Tonto, sheathed in the special rig made for her on Lidbelded Island, she secured to the inside of her left calf. She buckled on her gun belt, the Detonic Scoremaster 45 in one holster, the Beretta 92F she took from a man who kidnapped her and tried to rape her in the other. Spare magazines for both pistols, two of each, nestled in pouches on the belt. The rest of the magazines for her handguns, along with other miscellaneous gear, lay in a leather musette bag she carried that doubled as a purse, with her hairbrush and other necessities. Annie Rourke Rubenstein looked at herself in the mirror. She always felt slightly ridiculous suited up for the wilderness or for battle, and usually both. Since her girlhood, when their father woke them early from the cryogenics chamber, she felt compelled to express herself as female in a world where, then, the only two other humans were male, her father and brother. Desire became habit, and on those few occasions, when the extremes of climate demanded, she had to wear trousers, she felt terribly uncomfortable, unnatural almost.
Oh boy.
For the first time since the attack on her parents, she almost laughed, seeing herself in the mirror, skirt and combat boots, Peter Pan collar and gun belt. She sat down in front of the mirror and put on her earrings.
You will be killed.
So?
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 Colonel Mann can organize.
Colonel Mann can't do what needs to be done. He knows it and so do I.
But Michael, the war is over.
Only a major engagement, Maria. That's all that's over. The wars never end. There's an occasional truce, a lull in the fighting, and sometimes a shifting of alliances. But the war goes on forever, if you think about it.
What are you telling me, Michael?
That you love me, and I care a great deal for you, but I don't know when I'll be back, or even if. And I think you'd be better off without me.
Michael!
I'm sorry, but not for what I am.
Michael Rourke did not kiss Maria Lloyden. He simply looked at her one more time and left the room, walked along the corridor, took his gun belt from his shoulder and cinched it at his waist.
You behaved like an asshole toward her, Michael. She loves you.
Michael did not love her. That was a fact he could not escape.
Thank God Dad can't see into my mind now. Can't feel what's in my heart this instant.
Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna set down the receiver of the radio telephone. Frau Brunner put Jay on the line.
Natalia.
Yes. Did they tell you?
No, like...
You help Frau Brunner, okay?
Yes, no like.
Are we friends, you and I?
Yes.
Would you help me?
Yes.
Then help me now. And understand why I help my other friends, okay?
Yes. Love much.
He handed the receiver back to Frau Brunner.
Fraulein Major, when should we expect you back?
I do not know, Frau Brunner. I may never be back.
But Fraulein Major...
I have asked you to call me just Natalia or Fräulein Tyamarovna or whatever you like but that, my friend. And Frau Brunner, you can run the school not just as well as I, but better. I think we both know that, don't we?
Frau Brunner was silent for a moment. Natalia almost began to think the transmission was broken, but then her voice came back.
I will miss you, Natalia.
I will miss you, Clara. You are my good friend. Bless you.
Natalia stood now in front of the mirror, just looking at herself. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna was back in the world where she belonged, doing what presumably she was born to do, if one believed in fate. She secured her gun belt around her waist, just over the hips. She picked up the twin stainless steel Smith & Wesson L-frame 357 Magnum revolvers with their American Eagles engraved on the right barrel flats and holstered them. Natalia took the null shoulder holster from the back of the vanity chair, slung it on, securing the crossover strap to her gun belt. The PPKS, John rescued along with her from the fire, was already holstered, its suppressor in place. Finally, she picked up the Balisong from the small table the Germans provided her. Natalia flipped up the lock and wheeled the knife in her hand. The steel moved like something alive. She desperately wanted to trace its blade across the throat of Commander Dodd. Natalia closed the Balisong and secured it in the sewn-in pouch along the jumpsuit's right leg. She caught up her black purse that converted to a day pack and her parka. The lining of the black fabric jacket and the hood were made of synthetic fur, as warm and soft as the sable of the once glorious coat now stained and smelling of smoke from the fire. Natalia looked at herself one more time in the mirror. Had she not turned her face and held her breath, she would have inhaled enough of the cyanide gas to kill her. 5 centuries ago, she would not have survived in any event.
Am I better off now, or would I have been better off then?
Michael Rourke, his pack set on the concrete beside him, stomped his booted feet against the cold. The night was nothing but stars. No cloud cover, no precipitation, a sliver of moon. The night like velvet. He remembered the nights before the awakening, watching the stars with his father and his sister. Then Annie would go to bed. That was his time to sit with John, the hero, the legend, the demigod, his father. It was precious time, because in a short while his father would return to the sleep, to rejoin them once again in what was then a distant future. And the future never was, nor would it be, something to count on.
Why do you watch the stars, Dad?
Well, beats looking at you, right? Come here, little buddy.
Michael recalled his father wrapping his arm around him, John's hand tousling his hair, and longed for just an instant of that time again.
I like to try to guess what's up there, Michael.
You mean like the Eden Project?
Nah, they're men just like us.
That sounded pretty good at the time.
I just kind of wonder, that's all.
So do I.
What do you wonder about, Michael?
What's gonna happen in the future?
Well, now, nobody can tell that. And that's probably a good thing. If we knew all the happy moments and all the sad ones, Michael, we'd be so busy trying to rearrange everything, we'd never get anything done. Before you knew it, all the happy times would be gone.
What will the happy times be like, Dad?
Well, you'll know, Mike. And the sad times, too.
Michael took his father's old Zippo lighter from his pocket, then pulled off his outer glove and the liner. In the light from the airfield, he could just make out the steam rising from the palm of his hand as he turned the lighter over in his hands. The lighter was the one thing of his father's he had. But that was a lie. The lighter was only a tangible possession.
I have so much more of Dad. So many things more important than possessions. I have our memories, Dad. Everything you taught me, and our love for each other. No Commander Dodd. No assassins. No living death and cryogenic sleep can take any of that from me.
He held the lighter tight in his fist. Michael turned slowly at the sound of footsteps. It was Annie, looking for all the world like someone off for a walk in the countryside, yet dressed for battle, too. At her side strode Paul, his hands still bandaged under his gloves. Natalia, beautiful Natalia. And the last two members of their group, Bjorn Rolvag, the Icelandic policeman, and his wolf-like dog, Hrothgar. Natalia smiled.
Michael! Oh!
Annie gave him a big hug. Paul made a gesture that was something like a salute, and everyone looked at him. His eyes met Natalia's eyes, and they held each other's eyes for an instant. Then she cast her eyes down. In a moment, Michael Rourke realized that, for better or worse, he was the leader because he was John Rourke's son, and John Rourke could not lead them now. He held his rifle easily in his left hand. He held the Zippo in his right hand, inside his pocket.
Once we step off the base, we're no longer under the protection of New Germany. According to Dodd, Natalia's wanted. That means we're her accomplices, if I understand that sort of thing correctly. So it's likely anyone who's in league with Dodd will have orders to shoot us on sight, as criminals. Once the election takes place and Akiro takes office, we'll have the Eden government on our side. But until that time, we'll technically be criminals. Assuming those were some of his neo-Nazi pals who attacked the hospital, we'll have them to contend with too. Dodd must know the first Preble chases him. Let's not disappoint him.
Will we need anything from the retreat, Michael? I mean, eventually, they'll just blow the doors off if they have to, won't they?
Yeah, and he's right, Michael. Now or never for the retreat.
Michael looked at Natalia again and smiled.
They'll have to work at getting inside. We can use one of the escape tunnels to get in or out until they do. If there were the time, yeah, I'd say go in, take what we need, then destroy the rest so Dodd can't get his hands on anything. But there isn't the time to do that and find the baby. Priorities.
Agreed. Anything we might need, the Germans can make for us.
Michael looked toward the fence. They were going to cut it, with the full knowledge and permission of Colonel Mann, in order to exit the facility. Dodd would have the entrances to the base watched for their exit. There were irreplaceable family photos at the retreat, but memories were more than physical objects could ever be. And this was what his father and mother would want them to do, find the baby. And that was what they would do, or die in the attempt.